Welcome back for the second hour of Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're going to spend the first 10 minutes talking with Susan Klein, legislative liaison for Missouri Right to Life. Then it's open lines for about an hour or so, a little bit more than an hour, in fact. I want your answer to this question. Last week, I brought you the story about a Muslim imam who prayed an invocation in the Washington State House, not Washington, D.C., but the state of Washington. Several Republicans stepped off the House of the floor during the invocation. One has recently apologized. The other one who stepped off said the reason he left the floor was no coincidence, but he did not tell anyone why in particular he stepped off the floor. The question for you, and I asked this in passing last week during open lines, I'll ask it again, and I'd like your answer for it in about 10 minutes. The question for you is, what would you expect your elected representatives to do if a Muslim imam prayed the invocation to open that day's business in the House or in the Senate, Missouri, Illinois, no matter where you are? What would you expect your elected representatives to do? There was a poll that was taken by WorldNetDaily.com giving several options. And I'll share some of that with you in about 10 minutes. Last Thursday, there was a bill in the Missouri Senate that would let parents sue anyone who enabled a minor daughter to have an abortion without their consent. We're going to talk for about 10 minutes with Susan Klein, legislative liaison for Missouri Right to Life. Susan, welcome to Issues Etc.
Thank you, Todd.
Tell us what happened in the Missouri Senate last Thursday.
Well, as you stated, the Missouri Senate debated a bill that enacted a new section to our current parental consent law. The new section would give parents the right to sue anyone who would enable a minor daughter to have an abortion without their consent. There was an amendment added on the floor by voice vote that does concern us, that has a $1,000 limit to the damages that a parent would be allowed to obtain in the case that there was a lawsuit filed. So the underlying bill is great. We do need to have a bill that does give some meat to our current parental consent that would give parents the right to sue. We're just a little concerned about the $1,000 cap.
What is the current parental consent law in Missouri? How does it, what are its deficiencies? What does it outlaw? What does it prohibit?
Well, we do, the current law, we do have parental consent. It was upheld in, actually it was passed and approved by our Missouri lawmakers in 1979 and was upheld by the U.S. Supreme Court in 1983 that the minor daughter would have to have parental consent in order to obtain an abortion. The problem is that we have Hope Clinic in Illinois advertising in our St. Louis area that there is no parental consent required to have an abortion in Illinois. So we have people who are bypassing a parent's rights and care of their daughter and taking teenage girls across the Illinois and Missouri border into Illinois to obtain an abortion. So we do have parental consent, and it does have judicial bypass on it. But our problem at this point is that we don't have legal recourse for the parents. So that's what Senate Bill 34 does. It adds a civil liability clause onto our current parental consent law.
So in other words, within the borders of Missouri, it is illegal on the face of it for someone to either perform or for someone to have an abortion without parental consent when the woman involved, or the girl involved, is a minor child.
Yes.
Under the age of 18, I'm assuming.
Yes.
However, because Illinois has no such law, and in spite of the full faith and credit clause of the United States Constitution, there are people who are leaving Missouri, going to Illinois, getting the abortion, and this change in the parental consent law would allow parents some recourse in that kind of instance.
Yes, definitely.
Now, are there other damages that can be awarded beyond just the civil damages? Are there punitive damages that could be awarded as well?
Well, that's where our concern is. At this point, we have the amendment that was put on in the Senate on Thursday by voice vote put a $1,000 cap on it. Now, if you look at anyone going to court, if you're going to file a lawsuit, just to file the damages and all the litigation costs and everything could cost you a minimum of $15,000. So our concern is that a $1,000 limit is, you know, it may defer some parents from suing just because they know their costs are going to be extreme, although some parents are going to do it anyway because someone has taken advantage of their daughter. But we have a concern that just $1,000 might defer some because there's no further chance of getting anything past that $1,000, court costs or anything. So that's our concern with the amendment that was placed on the bill on Thursday in the Senate.
Now, this bill would, at least according to the AP report I have in front of me, would allow parents to sue a boyfriend, a school counselor, or anyone else who provides money or transportation for a minor to get an abortion. However, it doesn't seem to say anything about an abortion doctor who would perform the abortion without the consent of the parents. Is there anything in Missouri law within the boundaries of Missouri that would speak to that issue?
Actually, this bill, I mean, is looking at any person who violates this law shall be civilly liable. So I think it would cover the abortion doctor as well.
So could it conceivably cover not only the doctor who performs the abortion, but any staff person at an abortion clinic who would knowingly allow a minor child to have an abortion or facilitate that abortion in any way by way of paperwork or interview or anything, knowing parents had not given their consent?
It could.
So in other words, there could be multiple targets for such a lawsuit if the parents were willing to, you know, go the whole way on this.
Yes. Yes. I mean, we still have that $1,000 cap, but yes, they would have access as far as looking at anyone who undermined parental the consent of the parent would have civil recourse with this legislation.
Now, does the bill need to go to the House, and are there any obstacles between the Senate and the House before the bill goes up there?
The bill still has to go to the House, and if we are able to remove the cap in the House, which we hope we are, then we will have to go back to conference with the Senate. So we're hoping that we'll be able to, by the time we get the bill through the House and the Senate, we hope that we'll have the $1,000 cap off and we'll be back with a good bill in good form. Because, like I said, it is an excellent bill as far as the concept and what we're trying to do here with giving parents access to some kind of resources to look at people who undermine their authority.
What are the prospects for a signature from Governor Bob Holden?
I have not heard whether he will sign or won't sign. My guess is that he will not, but that would be a guess on Missouri Right to Life's part. We are hoping that he would, but I don't know that he has been friendly to pro-life bills in the past. So.
Is there any? Is it possible that he would veto the bill? A veto that could be overturned by the legislature?
Yes, we think that he probably will veto the bill, and we at Missouri Right to Life are already looking at an override session in rallying support for this bill, as well as we have informed consent out there. So we are looking and planning ahead for a veto override session.
And what about possible future court challenges? This is something that seems to happen as a matter of course in Missouri.
We expect any pro-life bill that would be passed and given us as pro-lifers across the state of Missouri the opportunity to override it, we expect that there would be a court challenge.
For those who want to speak out in favor of the passage of this bill in the Missouri Senate, what is the name of the bill?
It's Senate Bill 34. Senator John Loudon, and it is parental consent.
Susan Klein, thank you very much for being our guest on Issues Etc.
Thank you very much, Todd.
Susan Klein is legislative liaison for Missouri Right to Life. If you'd like to visit Missouri Right to Life on the internet, go to missourilife.org, missourilife.org. You can also phone them at area code 573-635-5100. That's 573-635-5100. The remainder of this hour and a bit of the next hour is open lines for your questions and your comments. I posed a question before talking in the last conversation about that Senate bill, about the Muslim imam who gave an invocation in the state of Washington in their house. two lawmakers walked off the floor. They didn't make a huff, they didn't scream, they didn't cry. They walked off the floor and absented themselves from the invocation. One said it was a matter of politics. Another said, well, I left and it was no coincidence, but I'm not going to tell you in particular why I left. One has apologized. The story, according to the Seattle Post-Intelligencer, reads as follows. In Olympia, he prayed for the politicians, the state's prosperity and peace for all ethnicities and religions. But when a Muslim cleric offered the opening prayer before the State House of Representatives yesterday, this is from last week's paper, at least two lawmakers stepped off the chamber floor. It's an issue of patriotism, said Representative Lois McMahon, a conservative Republican from Gig Harbor. She said her decision to stand in the back of the room had patriotic implications. The Islamic religion is so part and parcel with the attack on America, I just didn't want to be there or to be a part of that, she said. Even though the mainstream Islamic religion doesn't profess to hate America, nonetheless it spawns the groups that do hate America. Representative Kerry Condotta, a Republican from East Wenatchee, also left the floor. He said his timing was not a coincidence, but he declined to comment further on why he left, except to say that he was talking to another lawmaker and, quote, let's just say I wasn't particularly interested. A prayer is given at the beginning of each Senate and House session, and attendance is hit or miss, particularly on Mondays when this occurred. Imam Mohammed Joban of the Islamic Center of Olympia was the one who presented the opening prayer there in the Washington State House. Two walked off. The question for you, I'd like your answer to this during open lines for the remainder of this hour and into the next hour. What would you expect your lawmakers, your elected officials, your representatives to do in the same situation? In Missouri or in Illinois, what would you expect them to do? There's a poll taken by WorldNetDaily.com giving several options, and I'll have that for you in just a minute. Our phone numbers are 505-7850. Or 1-800-730-2727. As always, during open lines, you're free to discuss anything you'd like to discuss. Any topic, any question, or any comment is welcome at 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Perhaps you heard our conversation with Aaron Wolf from Chronicles Magazine and his questions, his concern about both the war on terrorism and the prospect of war with Iraq, and you'd like to react to it, you can do so at 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Here's the poll from WorldNet Daily. I won't give you the results right off the bat, just the options that are listed. And the question for you is, which of these options would you favor for your lawmakers? The question is, how would you respond if Muslim clerics gave a benediction at a public event? They have a broad question there. If a Muslim cleric gave a benediction at a public event, number one, I'd react like the Washington State lawmakers and walk out. That's one option. Another one, I'd pray my own personal prayer until it was over, kind of combating prayer or something like that. I'll balance his prayer with my prayer. Number three, I'd voice my objection loudly then and there. Number four, it makes me squeamish, but I'd be respectful. Number five, this is why there shouldn't be prayer at public events. Someone always gets offended. Another option is, I wouldn't listen at all. Another option, I'm not afraid of multiculturalism, so I'd listen. And then the final two options, Islam is as good as any other religion, so why not? And I'd love it since I am a Muslim. Now, those are the options that WorldNet Daily laid out in asking its question. If a Muslim cleric gave a benediction at a civic event, at a public event, what would you do during that benediction? My question for you, well, that's a good question, but my question for you is, what would you expect your lawmakers to do, your elected officials to do? I think it does happen on a regular basis in the states across the nation, or in our federal government, what would you expect your elected officials to do? Jim Talent, Senator Jim Talent, professed Christian. Oh, and I should mention in passing, now that Jim Talent's name comes to mind, that Jim Talent's pastor, Rodney Stortz, some of you may have heard this, it's very sad to announce his passing away yesterday. He had battled, had a long battle with cancer, as many knew. But in the days that were left to him, I personally called his office to commend him on two occasions for, interestingly enough, at events that were attended by Muslims in commemoration of September 11th, clearly speaking the word of law and gospel. I heard both events, and in both cases, Rodney Storch was the lone Christian minister in these events to clearly speak the message of sin and grace in Jesus Christ and Jesus Christ alone. I called his office both times to commend him for this. Rodney Storch has passed away. And there was another one. That was Jack Buck's funeral. And the memorial as well that was held there. Every time he got the gospel out. But back to the question. Jim Talent is a professed Christian. Makes no bones about this. If in the Senate there were a Muslim to give the opening prayer, the benediction, whatever you want to call it, what would you expect Jim Talent to do? He's there. Let's assume he's there. Would you expect him, if he knew in advance it would be a Muslim cleric giving the benediction, to simply show up late after the benediction? Just fashionably late so he wouldn't have to deal with the issue? Would you expect him to step off the floor? Would you expect him to bow his head and pray his own prayer? Or bow his head and simply keep silence? Would you expect him to say something? Or would you expect him to argue, in whatever venue it was appropriate, that perhaps it isn't appropriate for there to be prayers at all because someone's always going to get offended? Or maybe it's not appropriate for non-Christians to give benedictions and prayers in the Senate. It's a question for you I'd like your answer to it. Our phone numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Now, 47% of those polled agreed with the Washington state representatives in walking out. They would do the same. 24% say that they would pray their own personal prayer until it was over. And then the percentages get small indeed. About 11% said that they would voice their objection loudly then and there. And then dwindling off to smaller numbers, people who would say, well, I'd be respectful, or there shouldn't be prayer at all, or I wouldn't listen, or I would listen, or yes, I'd love it because I'm a Muslim. Far under 1%, in fact, 0.1% in answer to the WorldNet Daily poll said that. Now, the motivation of one of the lawmakers was, she said, political. She said it's a matter of patriotism. The association between Islam and the attack on America was too close for her. And so she simply did not want to be a part of it. She said, not all Muslims hate America, but the Islamic religion, in her words, spawns the groups that do hate America. And the other representative that stepped off the floor said it wasn't a coincidence that he stepped off the floor. But he said, let's just say I wasn't particularly interested. If you supported walking out, or your lawmaker walking out during a Muslim's benediction, what would be your reason for doing this? 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Or to put it another way, let's say that you were watching C-SPAN one night. You're bored, out of your mind. There's nothing else on. There's nothing to eat. Everyone else has gone to bed. They're C-SPAN or C-SPAN 2. And you're watching the business from the Senate. And you see the Senate chamber full or less than full. And very clearly, a Muslim imam giving a benediction, praying to Allah. Clear words, the likes of which, let's see, what if the prayer went something like this? And you're watching C-SPAN or C-SPAN 2. We open this session of the House of Representatives, or we say in this case, the Senate, in the name of Allah, the one God of Abraham, the God of Moses, the God of Jesus, the God of Muhammad, peace be upon them all. We ask Allah or God to bless the state so that it may continue to prosper and become a symbol of peace and tranquility for all people and all ethnic and religious backgrounds. We pray that Allah may guide this body in making good decisions for the people of the United States. You saw the Muslim cleric pray this prayer, and you noticed as the camera panned across the senators who were assembled there, Jim Talent standing with his head bowed. How would you react? Or, for that matter, any other senator that you know to be a professed Christian standing with their head bowed. Or perhaps you even noticed out of the corner of your eye through the C-SPAN camera, Jim Talent very carefully and discreetly stepping out of the chamber. How would you react? 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. That's the question I'm laying on the table for open lines during this hour. I have some other things as well. Picking up on our conversation with Aaron Wolf, he has deep concerns about the war on terrorism, not so much because he thinks terrorism is no threat, and not so much because he thinks America is somehow deserving of the terrorist threat. Neither of those things are true. His concerns stem from the fact that it might be feeding, or there might be at the heart of it in some cases. It goes more to motivation. This notion that America is somehow destined by God to do God's work in the world, as opposed to other nations. Now, he has concerns about it. According to the LA Times, the religious right is found to be likeliest to favor war in the case of Iraq. Americans who say religion is important in their lives are more likely to support military action against Iraq than those who identify themselves as non-religious, according to a new Gallup poll. Those who identify with the religious right are most likely to favor it, the poll also found. Among all adults surveyed in the poll, taken in late February, so this is not an old poll, 59% favored military action against Iraq, 38% opposed it. Among those who said that religion was not very important in their lives, 49% favored the war. And among those who said that religion is very important in their lives, 60% did. But there's more. The percentage favoring war was even higher. That is 70% among those who said that they considered themselves part of the religious right. Only 26% of that group said that they opposed the war. Now, here's something interesting. Just something for you to think about. We talked about this a little bit last week. Let's say, for the sake of argument, that all other circumstances were equal with the exception of one, the occupant of the White House. Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction. There were suspicions about his allies with worldwide terrorism. We've been waiting 12 years after a ceasefire in which he had agreed to disarm, but hadn't. We had inspectors in the country looking for things, finding them kind of in a piecemeal fashion. We had the UN in an uproar about these things. All of the things were equal in this situation, except for the occupant of the White House. Let's say, for the sake of argument, given the fact that that members of the religious right overwhelmingly support this war to the tune of 70%, if it were President Bill Clinton in the White House, same situation, but President Bill Clinton in the White House, do you think he would be garnering the support of the religious right for the war? We'll be right back.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
The courts of justice are there to protect our rights and to right the wrongs that occur between men. Should Christians take one another to court? What's the difference between conflict resolution and Christian reconciliation? Our Issues, Etc. book of the month for March is called Confession and Forgiveness by Ted Kober. You can order the book online by going to our website, issuesetc.org. Under the What's New section, you'll find information on the book, and you can even read an excerpt. issuesetc.org. Or order by calling Concordia Publishing House weekdays during regular business hours at 1-800-325-3040. Now, when you call, be sure to ask for the Issues, Etc. book of the month for March, Confession and Forgiveness, 1-800-325-3040, weekdays during regular business hours, 1-800-325-3040.
This is Family News in Focus. I'm Bob Dittmer. For the second time, the Third Circuit Court of Appeals has ruled that a law passed by Congress meant to keep internet pornography away from children is unconstitutional. Critics say the court isn't doing its job. David Brody reports from Washington.
The Third Circuit previously ruled the bill unconstitutional, saying the law's community standards definition was too broad. The U.S. Supreme Court disagreed and sent it back to the appeals court with the order to fix other free speech problems in the law. But the Third Circuit didn't fix it. They simply ruled it unconstitutional again, saying the law would make it too difficult for adults to view pornography. Bruce Taylor is with the National Law Center of Children and Families.
This court just committed one of the most irresponsible, unconstitutional acts by issuing an opinion where they struck the law instead of fixed it.
It's not surprising to Jan LaRue of Concerned Women for America. That's because of the court's liberal makeup.
This is a big disappointment, but not a surprise, because this Third Circuit is looking for ways to strike down this law.
And its decision will be costly.
Every day this law goes unenforced is another day that children are exposed to some of the vilest pornography on the internet.
Taylor says the Supreme Court will have to solve this mess.
And I kind of think there's a good chance that the Supreme Court will have to take the duty of saying, this is your job, but since you won't do it, we'll do it.
A repeat performance that could have been avoided. For Family News in Focus, I'm David Brody in Washington.
The law is called the Child Online Protection Act. President Bill Clinton originally signed it into law in 1998, but it has never gone into effect. The law makes it a criminal offense for any for-profit business to put pornography on its website without having some sort of adult verification mechanism in place to prevent kids from viewing it. For Family News in Focus, I'm Bob Dittmer.
On the next Midday Living Jubilee, live at 11:05 on AM 850 KFUO. Join me, Diane Summers, and perhaps Joni Harwell. We'll be talking with Dr. Jane Fryer about some prayer journals that might make some good exercise in Lent. We'll also talk with Dr. Stan Toler, senior pastor of Trinity Church of the Nazarene in Oklahoma City. Gives us some minute motivators for leaders. It all begins at 11:05, Living Jubilee on AM 850 KFUO.
How can confession and absolution help resolve conflict in the church? Find out with the new book, Confession and Forgiveness, published by Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040. Confession and Forgiveness is the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for March, 1-800-325-3040. You can find out more about this book on the Internet at issuesetc.org and click What's New? Confession and Forgiveness, our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for March.
Welcome back. It's Open Lines, Issues, Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. When is it the right time for you to confess your sins to, say, another Christian? When is it the right time to go, say, to your pastor, your minister, your priest, and confess sins privately there? When, if ever, is it appropriate for an individual Christian to confess his or her sins publicly to the congregation? The answers to some of these questions, and all of those questions, are found in our new Issues Etc. Book of the Month for March. It's called Confession and Forgiveness by Ted Kober. You can get the book for yourself and read it. It answers those questions and many more by calling Concordia Publishing House in the next 25 minutes at 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040, or you can order online by going to our website at issuesetc.org. Under the What's New section, you're going to find a direct link to Concordia Publishing House where you can order the book for yourself when you call or when you write. Ask to receive the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for March, Confession and Forgiveness. Call them at 1-800-325-3040. It's Open Lines, Issues Etc. The question on the table, what would you expect your lawmaker, your elected representative to do on the state or the national level if there was a Muslim cleric giving the benediction to open the session of the House or the Senate? And a question that I came up with right before the break, according to the LA Times, the religious right has been found most likely to favor war to the tune of 70% with Iraq. If everything else in this situation were equal, Saddam Hussein, the UN, the weapons inspectors, the weapons, you name it, if everything else were equal, except it were President Bill Clinton in the White House here in 2003, do you think that the religious right would still favor War with Iraq, 70% over 26%. Our phone numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. First-time callers, car phone callers, and internet callers get top priority. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Jay is calling from his car. Jay, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Hi, Pastor Todd. How are you?
I'm doing well.
I've got an opinion about the a state legislator or any legislator if they had a Muslim cleric in there. I would expect them to leave. But if they did stay and they bowed their head, I would really hope that they were talking to the true God while the Muslim cleric's talking to whoever he's talking to. And I've also got a, you know, the question about the far right. I mean the Christian right. I count myself there, and I'm proud of it. I don't think I'd have a change of opinion if Clinton were in the White House. And then I've got a question for you too.
Sure.
Or a couple. One's a comment. You know, they're quoting President Carter, and as if his opinions, you know, validate or counteract the opinions of real Christians. And I, everything about him that used to be Christian, I don't know if any of it still left.
Why do you say that? He is admittedly a Southern Baptist, and he is admittedly, and I think by his own admission, on the liberal end. He has aligned himself in the Southern Baptist Convention and spoken favorably of the liberal voices within the Southern Baptist Convention. I don't know what the particular issues are, but why would you say whatever there was in him that was Christian, you wonder whether it's still there?
But I'm not going to get real specific, but I've read some of the opinions he's expressed and some of the disagreements he has with the Southern Baptists. I didn't think he was even aligned with Southern Baptists anymore. I may be wrong there.
He's a member of a Southern Baptist congregation. And among Southern Baptists, that's about all the more aligned you can get. You know, they don't get more aligned than that, than to be a member of a congregation.
I've heard of his opinions regarding gays, abortion, and he's Southern Baptist. It's only in name only.
Jay, thank you very much for the call. I want to react to a few things he said. First of all, I think he might be making reference to the New York Times op-ed piece in which former President Jimmy Carter, I think it was yesterday's New York Times, laid out his case against war. Now, there's some things in there that I found rather remarkable. Like he said, and he was talking about just war theory. Now everybody wants to talk about just war theory. We were doing this 2 months ago. Now everyone decides to catch up with us and talk about just war theory. Well, in the things that he has outlined in just war theory, he's more or less correct, at least in the facts that he has in front of him. But in his application, I find interesting that former President Jimmy Carter says that there is no legitimate authority. That's one of the oldest tenets of just war theory. There is no legitimate authority for this war, and his reason is not because the president doesn't have the right to do it or authorization. If you remember in 2002, the U.S. Senate voted 70 to 23 to authorize the president to use force in Iraq. They voted to allow this. All right? It was a greater margin than they voted before the first Gulf War. But former President Jimmy Carter argues in the op-ed piece in the New York Times that the legitimate authority is forfeited not because the president doesn't have American authority to act, but because he doesn't have the UN's consent, which is an odd way of arguing for war, which would make most of the wars that America has fought illegitimate, with the exception of what? First Gulf War. UN resolution allowed that. I think the UN had something to say about Korea, and I think they had something to say about Afghanistan, and I'm not sure about any of the other wars, but all the other wars, at least according to former President Jimmy Carter, would be ruled out. But I like Jay's answer in this sense. I like Jay's answer because he said, the reason I'm questioning Jimmy Carter's Christianity or the genuineness or the content of his faith is not because of his view on the war. Had Jay said that, I think I'd have an argument with him. But he said, on other issues, and in particular, he talked about abortion and homosexuality, issues upon which God's word speaks clearly, See, it kind of goes to the question of this religious right in support of the war. I think I'm probably counted as a member of the religious right, although I don't know if I'd wear that badge so proudly. I'll wear it if I gotta wear it, if the shoe fits, wear it. But if President Bill Clinton were in the White House, or for that matter, if President Jimmy Carter were in the White House right now, all other things being equal, do you think the religious right would be 70% in favor of a war with Iraq? Our phone numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Jay says he would expect his lawmakers to step out of the House or the Senate if a Muslim imam were giving the benediction. What about the rest of you? What would you expect? What would you do if you were in that position? 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Do you believe that the religious right would be 70% in favor of the war as they are now if the occupant of the White House were different, namely President Bill Clinton, but all other things were equal? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Dr. Gene Edward Veith writes in World Magazine, as usual in the culture section, in the latest World Magazine, an article titled Saddam Sheikh. The connoisseurs of cool reject morality in their own lives, but give moralizing lectures against the United States. And he's talking about war protests. Now, I draw a very sharp distinction between war protest and those who have concerns about the war, about the prospect of war. Those who have concerns about it, I think everyone should have concerns about it. Although I happen to believe that the war is a good idea and a great idea at this particular moment in history, I think this is the time to do this, if there ever was a time to do it. I've been convinced not only by my general support for the president, that's probably the smallest factor, the largest factor being having spoken with people on this radio program who've made the case, in particular Michael Novak several weeks ago, making the case that we need to finish the business of the first Gulf War. Because all we had was, we didn't have a cessation of the war. The war isn't over. There was a ceasefire pending Iraqi disarmament, which has not been achieved in 12 years. Andy also argues about those two ingredients, worldwide terrorism and weapons of mass destruction, sitting side by side on the shelf, just waiting for someone to put them together. But I draw a distinction between war protest and having concerns about the war. I still have concerns about the war. I have concerns about the timing. I have concerns about all, just about everything, although I favor it. It does strike me as odd that there are people who have literally made up their minds against the war without any war on the table to be against. I think that's an altogether different thing than saying, I think war is a good idea at this time. And I'll share Dr. Gene Edward Veith's words with you about Saddam Sheikh and the postmodern nature of morality and war protests in a few minutes. Our phone numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Calling from his car, Tom is on the line. Tom, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Hello.
Hello, Tom.
Oh, thanks for joining the program, and I'm proud to take part.
Thank you.
The question about would support for the war be different if Clinton were still in the White House, I don't think has any validity, because if Clinton was still in the White House, I don't think it would have been pushed to this point.
Well, let's just say for the sake of argument that it was, because, yeah, we could, I anticipate that kind of a response, which is if it were President Bill Clinton rather than President George W. Bush, we wouldn't have taken the path we've taken up to here, and we wouldn't be where we're at right now. But let's just say, for the sake of argument, I'm asking kind of the hypothetical question of the mind. For the sake of argument, if he were in the White House and we were where we are now and everything were equal except for the occupant of the White House, do you think that the religious right would be supporting the war with Iraq to the tune of 70%? What do you think, Tom?
No, I do not. Now, although I enjoy sometimes listening to Christian radio in my travels, I'm not a Christian. And no, I don't think that you would have anywhere near a 70% support level if Clinton were in charge right now.
And why do you think that is? As briefly as you can put it, Tom, why do you think
that is? Well, to put it briefly, it is because I have never seen, and I'm not a Clinton supporter by any means. I'm an ultra-conservative. I'm just not a Christian. I have never seen someone so despised by the religious right as Clinton was, with some good reason.
So you think?
I think the Christian right would have difficulty in supporting Clinton, no matter what he advocated or what position we were in.
Tom, thank you very much. You know, I find it sad that we would actually have to step outside the pale of the Christian faith, a man who admittedly says he's not a Christian, to find someone who says, look, I just don't think they would support it because of the man. I want you to think about this, folks. Something as serious as war. Something as, well, need I say, irreversible as war. Once you go, you're gone. And once you drop a bomb, you can't suck it back up into the belly of the plane. And once you pull the trigger, you can't reel the bullet back in before it hits its target. Something as irreversible as war. Could it be that the religious right in general, and this is the broadest brush we could paint with, but that's the term, the religious right, could it be that the religious right in general's support for the war, to the tune of 70%, has less to do with the facts at hand and more to do with the president himself? That if the facts at hand were the same and there was a president in the White House that they did not trust, the way they didn't trust President Bill Clinton, do you think they'd be supporting the war? What about you? Would you support war with Iraq if Bill Clinton were still president? And all other we've swept away the notion that we wouldn't be in the same situation. Granted, we wouldn't be in the same situation. Who knows? By this time, we might have hover cars and all be wearing spandex with a third term of Bill Clinton. But if all other things were equal, would you be in support of the war with Iraq? 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Give us a call. Answer that question. What would you do if a Muslim were making the benediction in the state house where you live and you were an elected representative? Would you stay on the floor during the benediction or would you walk out? Would you simply stand quietly and do nothing? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Harvey is calling from O'Fallon, Illinois. Harvey, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Good day, Pastor Todd. How are you?
I'm doing well.
I think as a former military person in defending the rights of all Americans, I would stand with my head bowed. As a Christian, I would find myself praying to the Lord Jesus Christ while he's praying to Allah. And I think that a dual citizenship thing is almost in existence here, where we have our rights and our responsibilities as American citizens, but we also have our responsibilities to the Lord our Savior.
Do you think that a Muslim imam should be invited to pray for the opening benedictions of state houses or perhaps the U.S. House of Representatives or Senate?
No, sir. I would I'd back off on that. But again, that's my Christian perspective. And I would much rather see one of our own ministers called, and that is the heritage that we have all enjoyed and what we have long fought for and defended.
And at the same time, Harvey, to recall something you said at the very beginning of your call, you said as someone who has served in the military in defense of every American's rights to worship as they would, I assume that's what you were talking about.
Yes, sir.
Do you see a conflict there with saying, well, I would defend every, if there was a prayer being made, I would respectfully bow my head and pray to the true God, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit.
Right.
But if it was a question of actually inviting the imam to come and give the benediction, you wouldn't think that would be appropriate. Do you see any conflict there?
No, I don't. I think that most of our country's heritage is Christian, and I believe if there is a Muslim serving in the Senate, and they're going to invite one of their clerics, and you know that's a different issue. But as far as us seeking them out, I don't see the purpose in us evangelizing for the Muslims. We should evangelize ourselves.
Well, okay, I mean that's the issue of evangelism. What if? Let's another what if, another hypothetical.
Okay.
This is far-fetched. But what if the number of Muslims in this country were not as small as it is? We say maybe 7,000 Muslims in the United States I mean, 7 million Muslims in the United States all said, that's a very small percentage of the population. But what if, say, 100 years down the line, we're talking more like 40%, where people say, yeah, our heritage may have been Christian, but now we are a largely, although it's a minority, a very large minority of our population is Muslim. Do you think the situation would be different there about inviting someone?
I think that the fact that we would have Muslims in those particular bodies of our government would, they would invite their people there. And I don't see myself as a Christian doing it. But I understand that the economy that we face, and it's one of the things of living in a free country. And I would also like to address, and if you don't mind me changing the subject,
I'd like to address
the topics that you mentioned before about the Christian right in either President Carter or President Clinton. I think that we have a tremendous difference there, that the Christian right is not necessarily just supporting the man. I believe the man has demonstrated his ability as a leader, and therefore I believe that's where a lot of the faith comes from. I was in the military when President Carter was in office, and in fact I served in the SAC Underground Command Post. And I don't know if I can say things even yet about what I heard done with and by President Carter then, but I don't think he quite honestly, it's an old-fashioned term, I don't think he had the stomach to do it. He just didn't have the guts to stand up to him. And as a president, as a Christian, in what his beliefs were then, I respected the man himself immensely. But I never respected his ability as a leader because he failed to lead.
So in other words, you're adding another wrinkle to this, it seems, Harvey. You're saying that you would take into account not merely your kind of gut reaction to the man in the White House with regard to support for the war,
mm-hmm.
or what you think of them, their character. You would also take into account the track record of what you call leadership.
I would certainly say that's true. And, especially in President Clinton's case, he had a terrible record as a leader. And, he was probably the least respected of any president that the military's ever had in the United States. And
well, that may well be, Harvey. I thank you very much for the call. But as to the question, his track record regarding leadership, you know, my gut reaction is to agree because I was not altogether happy with either term of the Clinton presidency for a number of reasons, on a personal level, not altogether happy at all. But I imagine there's someone who could mount an argument, say, well, with regard to leadership, you may have disagreed with the direction he was leading, but with regard to effective leadership, he got the job done. In fact, isn't that what the religious right found so very infuriating and frustrating in many cases, apart from his personal peccadilloes? In many cases, they found so frustrating is that he did get things done. One of the things he got done, one of the ways he quote-unquote led, was by pulling conservative issues out from under conservatives on a regular basis, pulling the rug out from under them and taking those issues and making them his own and getting them done. I mean, conservative commentators, much larger than myself, have observed that during the Clinton presidency, there was a greater advancement of conservative causes, largely due to his style of leadership, which was to steal everyone else's issues as his own and lead. So someone could make the argument that in the direction he went, he led effectively, although you disagree with the direction he was going. It's kind of like driving your car either toward or away from your destination. Whether you're driving it toward your destination or away from your destination, whether you're driving the right way or the wrong way, you wouldn't say, well, the car is running rough when we drive this way, but it's running smoothly when we run that way. No, the car is running the same. Hitler was a leader of, well, that's what they called him. The Führer, the leader. He was a leader of historic proportions. Where he led the people of Germany was horrific, but no one could argue with the fact that the guy was an effective leader as far as leadership goes, which should give the church pause as it runs headlong toward the fad of leadership. Leadership for leadership's sake is not necessarily a good thing. In fact, probably history teaches that in more cases than not, leadership, effective leadership, can be very dangerous. Our phone numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Wade, waiting on, in his car patiently. Welcome to Issues, Etc.
Hi, Todd. Todd, I just would like just to get this out in the open, and I don't know how much you've talked about this at all, but I don't know how many Kurds that Saddam Hussein had gassed, but the numbers that I hear seem insignificant to the amount of children that are killed daily in the United States through abortion.
Oh, yeah. I mean, if you add them up, absolutely, by far, there's no comparison in sheer numbers. You're right.
And I certainly wouldn't want to be in the president's shoes, but I seem to think we've got a greater war to turn that around than we do in our own yard and try and control someone in another land with his people when we are just if we use that as our argument to go in there, I just don't think it's strong enough considering how many children are killed daily.
Wade, thank you very much for that comment. I couldn't agree with you anymore. It's a good example of the United States pointing its concern about human rights and its sensibilities about human rights that I think are all very good at other countries and other sovereignties, and ignoring what can only be called a Holocaust in violation of the human rights of Americans called abortion. If we were really concerned about human rights, like, well, you know, one of the more basic, without which you can't have other rights, like life, if we were really that concerned about human rights, perhaps we would be more concerned about what's going on within our country. We are aborting 4,000 a day, Americans. The last time I checked, being born in America makes you an American. I would like to push that back to being conceived in America makes you an American, but the Supreme Court disagrees with me. The Supreme Court thinks that you've got to actually breathe your first breath before that makes you an American and worthy of protection under the U.S. Constitution. I think if we were speaking and thinking sensibly here in America and really concerned about human rights, outside and inside our borders, we would be arguing in favor of being conceived in America makes you an American. After this break, there's 25 minutes of open lines. You can call now during the break. It's a great time to call. 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. The last half hour of the program we're going to spend with Wesley Smith. He's senior fellow for the Discovery Institute. We'll talk to him about a new public relations campaign by PETA. And he's outraged. We'll find out why. In the last half hour of the program, Open Lines is next.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues, Etc. Issues, Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues, Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues, Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.